Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, NBC is bailing on the Golden Globes. After a series of studios, including Warner Brothers, Amazon, and Netflix, bailed on participating in the Hollywood Foreign Press Association's annual shindig, and stars like Scarlett Johansson denounced the governing body's sexist practices, while Tom Cruise returned the three Golden Globes he has won, the network said it will not air the show's 2022 incarnation unless massive changes are made. The Globes was embroiled in scandal even before the year's disastrous COVID-related ratings dip. Exposés revealed, among other things, that the HFPA's members were getting rich off participating in junkets and the such, while there were exactly zero black members of the HFPA. That's a problem these days. The show has always been a bit of a joke, judged as it is by a handful of goobers no one has ever heard of, raining nominations down on series and shows that had been kind enough to send the members to fancy locales and put them up in glorious digs. This results in things like the roundly hated Emily in Paris nabbing a handful of nominations. On the one hand, anything that diminishes the power of the HFPA is probably good, because the HFPA is a joke organization, and the idea that it should have any actual impact on the Oscars is insane. On the other hand, guys, come on, like, you knew the deal when you got into bed with these idiots, and nothing has changed. I think we can all get off our high horses, Tom Cruise. Ridiculous, sending back your Golden Globes. Come on. Before this story broke literally hours before we were going to do this, we were going to do a segment on Seth Rogen and James Franco, and I felt like kind of the same way when Seth Rogen saying, like, I'm not going to work with James Franco anymore. Like, you worked with him for 20 years. Like, you knew what was going on, guy. Still, this is a blow, and not just to the award season gadflies. As Eddie Muller, the Noir Foundation founder and president, noted in a thread on Twitter, the HFPA's annual NBC bounty helps keep his and many other organizations doing the important work of film preservation afloat. Here's Muller. HFPA's charitable trust annually provides grants to film organizations that urgently need subsistence funding. My Noir Foundation would not be able to save as many films without HFPA's generous aid, end quote. Alyssa, isn't there something weird about the fact that what is going to bring down the HFPA is not its terrible taste and not the terrible movies or terrible TV shows that it's awarded, and it's not the terribly blatant corruption amongst the members that is the problem here, but because the corrupt idiots handing out the bogus statues just needed, like, some other more diverse corrupt idiots in their crew? Like, I'm actually, like, it's one of these things where, like, this is like Al Capone getting down for tax evasion style, punishment.
I mean, is that entirely what's happening? Or is it that, like many other award shows, the Golden Globes cratered this year, and therefore it's maybe worth it to NBC to have some sort of fight, get out of its contract, and try and find something that advertisers will actually want to pay to be across it?
This is another angle to all this, right? Is that the Golden Globes were down, what, 60% year over year. The thinking is, you know, award shows are on the decline anyway, so this is a way for NBC to get out of their contract, which I grant there's probably some accuracy to that. But it wouldn't have happened without all of this other stuff surrounding it, right?
I think it's a lot of stuff. For a column I'm working on, I was sort of looking up the list of just terrible things that are associated with the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. And there are so many of them that I had forgotten that in 2018, Brendan Fraser accused the former president of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association of sexually assaulting him. And somehow the guy didn't get thrown out until this year, when he sent an email to a bunch of HFPA members saying that Black Lives Matter is a racist hate movement. Like, these people are bonkers. And so, yeah, maybe it's partially about race. Maybe it is about Scarlett Johansson and other people not wanting to participate in the junkets because they don't want to get leered at and sexually harassed in the questions. Maybe it's that, you know, NBC has been paying $60 million a year for the right to do this through 2026. And if you stop being able to sell ads across the thing because 8 million people are watching it and it has a toxic reputation, like, all of that comes together in a gigantic storm. And you know, maybe even if they have to pay some money to get out of the contract, and it's entirely possible that they're only doing this for 2022. They haven't said that they're trying to get out of the contract entirely, as far as I know. You know, maybe the, like, maybe cutting your losses and not continuing to be associated with an organization that is clearly an omni-shambles just makes good sense. I mean, the HFPA is so nuts that they hired Judy Smith, who is the inspiration for Olivia Pope on Scandal, right? Like, she's supposed to be the crisis fixer who takes the worst cases. She works with them for a couple of weeks and just decides that they are so terminally screwed up that she quits in disgust, right? I mean, these are, like, these are bad people to be in business with, not just because they're racist, not just because they're corrupt, but because they're crazy-making. And nobody wants to work with them. So I think it's any one of a number of things that convince NBC to finally cut bait. But, like, it's not just that, you know, the corrupt organization was insufficiently diverse. It's that they're nuts and impossible to deal with. And the publicity is bad. And you can't make money off it. If 40 million people had tuned into the Golden Globes, NBC would not be doing this.
Yeah, so the NBC statement definitely leans on what I think are pretty clearly references to the lack of diversity. So the NBC statement is, we continue to believe that the HFPA is committed to meaningful reform. However, change of this magnitude takes time and work, and we strongly feel the HFPA needs to do it right, blah, blah, blah. Basically, and then says, we're not going to air it next year. We hope we can air it in 2023. The reform plan that the HFPA released was at least partially about increasing, I'm reading from Variety here, includes measures to increase the number of people of color in its ranks, also includes new restrictions on gifts that members could receive, payments for work on their committees, that sort of thing. So it wasn't exclusively about diversity, but diversity was certainly a headline part of the reform plan that NBC is citing as not being there yet and not being ready to go. Which is why they're saying they won't air the show next year.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious what sort of reforms they could institute that are going to, you know, get to the heart of the problem, which is that it's a terribly corrupt organization where the actual quality of the thing in question doesn't matter. I mean, this is like the crime with the Golden Globes. I don't care that they're crazy. I don't even care that they're corrupt, really. Like, the problem is...
You do care
is,
about the corruption a
I care,
little.
I care more about the corruption than I do about anything else involved in this story. But, like, the thing that is bad about the HFPA is that they are awarding things that are not good. Like, it's their taste that's bad more than anything else. How are they supposed to solve the fact that their taste is bad?
Pia Zadora, best newcomer, you know? And they've always been bad, right? I mean, charges that the HFPA has fixed votes on things go back to 1958.
Right. I mean, there was like a FTC scandal about this. There was talk about them, like, they couldn't be on TV for a long time because of this sort of thing. I mean, look, the problem again, the problem here is that you have like what's the actual number? It's like 75 or 84 or something like that.
It's 80 something, I believe, people on the board.
Faceless, nameless goobers, as I put it. Making all these decisions. I like what is the point of the Golden Globes? This is my like kind of final point here is that like the Globes have always been ridiculous. Why not just let them continue to be ridiculous? I don't understand why people are getting up on their high horse now about it. That's the thing that I don't get.
They can NBC's continue move. To be ridiculous. I just think that NBC can't make as much money off the ridiculousness as it used to. Yeah. That's what it comes down to.
Part of this is that NBC is following the pack. This comes after you have Netflix, Amazon, Warner Media all saying that they're not going to work with HFPA, right? And so to some extent, NBC just is sort of following the lead of other big corporations in the film industry here. But it's also, I think, pretty clearly, like I said, the stated reason for dropping them is that they're not fulfilling their reform plan. You see some of the reporting in Variety saying, oh, they had this reform plan, but they didn't actually have any plans to implement it on a timeline. They just like came up with some stuff that they were maybe going to do at some point whenever they felt like it. But
less
it wasn't
corruption.
Real. Right. Yeah, let's maybe not more like, minorities. But, like, they weren't really going to do it, and NBC like, hands like, started up in the to air. Realize that they weren't really going to do it. But I also think that so much of the stated reason is a cover for the fact that they're looking at the Golden Globes ratings this year, looking at the overall product from this show and saying, we do not have the ability to make money on this anymore. And we are skeptical that we are going to have the ability to make money off of this. And that's partly because of the scandal that's associated with it. It's partly because all of these big companies, right? I mean, if you don't have Netflix and Amazon working with with HFPA, then that rules a lot of films out of contention, that pulls big stars out of being able to appear for this, for the ceremony, right? Like it just, there is a sort of there's a death spiral here going on in which everybody is at once saying for whatever reason, and some of it is, you know, some of it's diversity, some of it's they're crazy, some of it's they're corrupt, some of it's just, hey, the ceremony ratings were really spectacularly bad this year. Everybody is saying at the same time, what are we doing here? HFPA is not providing us with any value in exchange for our engagement with them. And what our engagement with them is getting us is negative press because we are supporting a group that is crazy and everybody hates for some reason.
For good reason. Here is the...
For many different reasons, some of which may be great reasons and others of which may be not so great reasons. But it seems like there are quite a few good reasons to dislike the HFPA.
Here's the real question is if this is a move by NBC to get out of an onerous contract, and I think it largely is.
It's got to be at least part of it. Yeah.
Does that mean, do we think then that this means that NBC is looking at the awards landscape in general and saying these things are donezo? Because I am curious. They were all trending down anyway. All TV is trending down, and people are moving to different forms of watching content. They're getting away from scripted programming on TV. There's lots of time shifting. It used to be that live events like the Globes or sports or whatever were the kind of last bulwark against this. But now you have this situation where all of the award shows did between 8 and 10 million viewers this year. And that's because of COVID. It's because of weird release schedules. It's because of whatever. But the point is, people aren't watching award shows. Do we look at this and say, okay, NBC has decided that live award shows are no longer a thing that are going to be a going concern in like 4 to 5 years?
Yes, I think that's basically right. And that's especially true with the Golden Globes, because to the extent that they had a value, the ceremony itself had a value, it was in being a warm-up for the Oscars. It didn't actually have all that much value on its own. What it was a bellwether. It told you sort of where the awards race was. Nobody actually cared about the Golden Globes independently of the Oscars or the rest of the awards race. And so the Golden Globes were pretty clearly going to be the first on the chopping block as these things started to get cut from network schedules, because who actually cares about the Golden Globes? And this is why this is such an easy decision, I think, for NBC to make, is that there just aren't that many people in the world. I'm not saying there's nobody out there ever, but there just aren't that many people who really care about the Golden Globes. I mean, they got 14 fans, right? It's like, it's not a thing that anybody gives a shit about.
Alyssa, do we think that the kind of decline of awards viewing tells us anything about the state of, you know, what people actually care about? Are we just is this a we don't care about these specific movies things, or we're tired of hearing from the rich and the famous give themselves awards and talk about how great they are?
I think it's probably a combination of both those things. I'd also add that the rise of social media has made award shows less valuable as sort of a glimpse into famous people reacting to things, right? I mean, it used to be that, you know, you got your information about celebrities, you know, way back in the day from, you know, sort of heavily controlled gossip columnists, then from glossies like People, that had this sort of very filtered and edited view of celebrities. And so the Golden Globes, actually, in particular, were known for being sort of like a drunk and out of control. And they were an opportunity when a celebrity, perhaps genuinely surprised by a win or a loss, might do something unusual. I mean, you know, for all that it's like, it's sort of a weird moment, like Kanye West rushing the stage and, you know, interrupting Taylor Swift is like actually a genuinely great moment of live television. But if you don't need that to see Kanye West like acting out whatever his personal tsuris is, if you don't need the Golden Globes to see celebrities like get a little sloppy because they're doing that on their own Instagrams in order to boost their overall numbers so they can sell, you know, sponsored content to you, like the filter is down between famous people and Hollywood. And in many cases, it has been deliberately lowered by the stars themselves. And so the award shows are less useful as a peek into that world. And I think that I would not underestimate that either.
Exit question. Is Ricky Gervais the only man who can save us now? Alyssa, rolled your eyes so hard. They fell out of your head.
If by save us now you mean prompt me to throw myself into the sun without JVL having to launch me there, then yes.
Peter.
No one can save us.
I mean, I do think Ricky Gervais is at least more entertaining than, you know, 90% of everything else that happens on that show. So come on, Ricky, come back to the show. Save us. We're all hoping for you. If you enjoy the show, and who doesn't, it's great. Make sure to head over to atma.thebulwark.com, where we'll have a special bonus members only episode arguing about one of our favorite topics. Which Jason Statham movie is best? Do we prefer funny kick-ass Jason Statham or somber kick-ass Jason Statham? Hard to say. It's the perfect follow-up to our discussion of the new film Wrath of Man, only in theaters, which starts right now. Now onto the main event. Wrath of Man. The new action thriller from Guy Ritchie and Jason Statham. Ritchie and Statham previously teamed up for Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch, as well as the modestly disastrous Revolver. And the trailers for Wrath of Man promise something kind of in the vein of those films. Stylish, a bit funny, full of action. And instead, what we got was something more akin to a British crime drama from the 1970s or early 1980s. A darker, more remorseless, slightly less frenetic movie that called to mind Get Carter, the Michael Caine version, or The Long Good Friday, than it did Snatch or recent Ritchie hit The Gentleman. I have some quibbles with Wrath of Man. There's a whole subplot with Andy Garcia as a detective that's completely unnecessary. I have no idea why it's in there. And I'm not sure I loved the chapter-like structure or the way the film constantly shifts POV, which reveals too early the central mystery of why Statham's character, H, is trying to catch a gang of armored car thieves. But on the whole, I really dug its whole vibe. This is a movie that lures you in with silly banter before revealing itself to be a brutal and violent journey into the heart of criminal darkness. The violence is intense, but never cartoonish. The choices these characters make have irreparably terrible and terrifying consequences. Plastic bags have never been scarier, for instance. And Statham has rarely been this somber. Not my favorite mode for him, to be entirely honest. While Scott Eastwood, surprisingly, is finally learning to embrace his father's stone-faced sneer and glare. He's getting there, folks. He's getting there. We can delve into the plot a little bit more in a moment. Again, I have some issues here, particularly with the ending. But I just want to take a moment to luxuriate in the fact that this is a real-ass movie playing in real-ass movie theaters. Like the opening opera invasion of Tenet, the opening shot of this film has a vibe that screams cinema. It's a single shot that swoops into an armored car, positions us in the back seat, and obscures our view out of the front windshield while intentionally making it kind of hard to hear what's happening. Now, it's telling a whole little story in this 2-minute shot, and it's the sort of thing that really you still just don't see on TV that much. It's a movie shot. It's a shot that screams, "Hey, we're in the movie theaters." Peter, what did you make of Wrath of Man?
I quite liked it. This is a departure for Guy Ritchie, whose movies I find generally enjoyable, with some exceptions, Chav King Arthur, notably. But this is something else. This is a different kind of film for him, even though it is another crime film with Jason Statham in the lead, and that has a whole bunch of like stylishly dressed men, you know, sort of a bunch of different gangs kind of going after each other. Right? This is This is a movie that flirts at times with real darkness and real sadness. And it is, it's not just grim for its own sake. It's grim because there's something, sort of real at the heart of this. And I can't, I almost wonder after The Gentleman, I said this to Alyssa after the screening, I almost wonder, like, what got Guy Ritchie to make this film? What is it? It seems like there's something sort of strangely personal about this, even though it is not an obviously, like, personal, you know, this isn't a story about his life where he's transferred, right? It's not that kind of personal. It's something else, though, but there's just something in this where it really has, like, a kind of a depth of feeling to it that I think is unusual in his work. And is unusual to see in an action movie like this, because it is ultimately about a father's pain and about loss in a way that you just don't see in these movies. It's also just, it's exceptionally well directed. That opening shot, it's really is so great. And you talked about just sort of the cinematic quality of it. But I just want to praise this, as we have seen in the last 30 years or so, really sort of in the post-Heat era, so many big heist sequences, and so few of them have really kind of moved the needle. And like, you, at this point, you've kind of seen all the ideas, right? And you can even like think of something like Without Remorse, which this movie in many ways delivered on some of the promises that Without Remorse made in its trailers. There's that terrible kind of like hijacking, you know, sequence at Dulles Airport in Without Remorse that just borrows a couple of tropes from Heat and then doesn't even pay them off very well. And this movie actually gives us something different. It gives you something I've never seen before in a heist sequence, which is a single shot from inside the car. And so what you're not feeling it from the perspective of the robbers, you're feeling it from the perspective of the people who are being robbed, and you're getting the information in a lot of ways. Now, eventually they move out of the truck, but you're getting the information that they have, which is not enough, and it's scarier because of the things you don't see, right? It's more tense because of what you don't see. And it's just a really, really effective use of like camera movement, but also of information delivery. And that's what this movie does so well. And actually, we'll push back on the final thing I'll say here, Sonny, is I want to push back on your complaints about the story and the structure, because I think this movie does a really, really good job with information delivery, both in terms of the shots it chooses, but also in terms of the script and the way that it just sort of slowly moves you through the backstory of all the different parts and pieces of all the different gangs and all the different characters that led to this opening moment. And then and most of the movie is about unwinding that opening moment. And then you have the final third act, right? The last 30 minutes or so, basically, after we see from the outside, we see the truck heist again. And then what we see is that, and then the third act is sort of, here's the consequences of that. And I just think it's so smartly done. It reminds me a lot of Quentin Tarantino. You've got the chapterized bits. You've got the stuff being told out of order. There's a little bit of Hateful Eight kind of structure, a little bit of Reservoir Dogs there. And I just thought it was so smart and so effectively done. I do agree with you that it's a little bit of a cop out in the end. This movie doesn't quite want to go as dark as some of it seems to suggest.
Before we get to Alyssa, I'm very curious to get her take on this. But the issue for me with the structure is that it has this great shot at the beginning that sets up like essentially a mystery, like what happened in this robbery, why did it go wrong, why is Jason Statham so interested in like figuring out who pulled it off, and then it just like answers them all in the next 40 minutes, and then there's still an hour and 20 minutes of movie after that. I feel like that is you have to, if you're going to structure it like that, it needs to pay off all at the end. I don't know it
answers the question quite of why he's mad first, but then it leaves a second question, which is who did it and who's he mad at? And that's it does, what comes but it, out in the but last that, 45
that,
minutes.
No, but that doesn't come out in the last 45 minutes. It comes out in the middle, like 30 minutes. It comes out in the middle 30 minutes.
I want to hear what Alyssa has to say.
Alyssa, I did not think you were going to like this movie. In fact, we had joked about this being a Mother's Day movie. I was like, this is specifically not a Mother's Day movie. But you liked it. You were very effusive in your praise of it. What did you like about Wrath of Man?
Yeah. I periodically enjoy, I mean, I kind of joked about this on Twitter. It's like, I both hate, the code of masculinity that involves, you know, everyone, avenging themselves in like the bloodiest, stupidest possible fashion. And also really enjoyed this movie. Like, I contain multitudes. But I thought there was something really interesting going on, in the movie that each of you have its identified part of, but that I want to take a little bit further. And I think that, you know, all of us really love that opening sequence with the sort of obscure, you know, the very specific obscured perspective of the heist. But I think this is a movie about information control, and what the lack of information does to us in our decision making and in our morality. And I think that's reflected really well in both the in the cinematic choices and in the script. And Sunny, I know that you don't like the fact that the mystery is solved for us before it's solved for H, but I actually think that that adds to the moral dread of the movie, right? You understand, once you know why he can't figure out who the criminals are, and the answer is that because they are not part of the traditional networks of criminality in Los Angeles. Like, they will not show up from him shaking, you know, the trees of various other gangs and crooks, because they have no relationship to those gangs. You start to see the cost of what he's doing, right? He kills and tortures an enormous number of people in a quest for personal revenge that is headed in entirely the wrong direction. And that means that he becomes sort of, you know, to the extent that a, you know, notorious crime lord can become more morally compromised, where he becomes more morally compromised, where even the people who are working for him, who, you know, are brutal and ruthless, have real doubts and qualms about what they're doing. And it's all wrong, right? And then even within sort of this little cell of criminals that you get to know in parallel, you know, the sort of lack of the ways in which the characters extend trust that isn't necessarily deserved or warranted, and the decisions they make sort of without complete information about what they're walking into. It enhances the viewer's sense of doom, right? I mean, we don't have visual cinematic perspective on what's happening at every point in the movie. And in fact, I think one of the reasons that this was not just sort of bearable, but good for me, was that a lot of the worst violence is sort of out of the corner of your eye. We don't have complete visual perspective, but we, as the movie goes on, always have slightly more moral perspective than the characters do once we get sort of the first flashback. And I think those two things work together in really interesting ways to make this a really sad movie. I think, and spoiler alert here, if that's okay.
Yeah, we're gonna get spoilery from here on. So just, folks, if you want to see the movie, and you should, it's a good movie, go see it and then come back to this podcast at this time, whatever time it is right now.
I think it is a huge mistake at the end of the movie that they don't kill Statham's character at the moment when it seems like he's dead. Because that would really clearly complete the point that, you know, this may be vengeance, but it's also just complete and utter self-destruction. And it settles for a sort of, you know, this has been a sort of morally corrupting, miserable experience that has not actually brought H his son back. But I think it was just sort of a cop-out to let him come back and actually kill the guy who killed his son. And it's very, like, I mean, if they had stuck with that decision, you know, I could see this taking that sort of last step to be sort of a morally uncompromising great movie. I don't think it's there. But I really enjoyed the sadness in it and the fact that it doesn't, the movie never lets Statham's efficiency as a killer overwhelm that sense of sadness. Like, even in, you know, you have this early set of scenes where he is either, you know, murdering Post Malone, who, as I said to Peter, has become like the go-to person that you have murdered early in an action movie because he's annoying and it's satisfying to see him murdered on screen. Or even when he is like staring down and scaring off his old gang when they accidentally attempt to rip off the car that he's in. Like, he's awesome. The movie has a little bit of fun with that, especially through like Rob Delaney's, you know, corporate honcho guy who's like, he's murdering people. He's a legend. It's awesome. But somehow there's enough sort of tonal control in this movie that air of sadness and grimness, you know, doesn't get swept away by those moments. And I'm not a huge Guy Ritchie fan because I think he often has problems with that sort of calibration, but I actually think he pulls it off really
well. Yeah, I think the ending is it's worth just talking about just a little bit, because I think the ending is symbolic of or representative of the film's biggest problem, which is that it wants to be a pretty dark and despairing film, and for the most part it pulls that off tonally, but it also doesn't quite have it's timid about making Jason Statham's character a true bad guy. And so even in those sequences in the middle where he is torturing people, like the bad guy, there's always a worse bad guy who gets what he deserves, right? Like you go to the movie wants to have a sense of justice, and it wants to make Statham a deliverer of justice, right? And to make him to not morally compromise him in a deep way.
And in the torture scenes, they often have him providing the sort of moral out, right? Like they torture a guy and his girlfriend. He gives them information that they think is going to be valuable. And, he, you know, H tells his goons to give the guy $200,000 and the key to a truck. They break up a pornography ring that has nothing to do with the fateful hijacking. He kills the like sort of sadistic pornographers and then gives all the cash they have on hand to the women that they've basically been trafficking.
The movie wants to have its cake and eat it too, and that's the big problem with the end, where Statham survives what should have been a mortal wound for the second time in the film, and comes back to kill Scott Eastwood.
I think everybody knows that you can't kill Jason Statham. Don't even try.
The problem with this is that you could have easily still had Scott Eastwood's character receive justice while also driving home this idea that vengeance is ultimately self-destroying, that wrath of man destroys man himself, right? Because I remain convinced that the whole Andy Garcia detective subplot was a vestigial plot point where Jason Statham does die. I'm convinced there's a cut of this movie where Jason Statham actually dies, and at the end of the film, the cell phone that he has slipped into the bag is you know, brings either his crew of baddies or Andy Garcia to Scott Eastwood's house, and they take him down. They take him to jail, or
so
they
kill
him, or whatever.
So you're convinced that there's an ending that's basically Promising Young Woman?
More or less. I mean, I think that there's that would have been a more, I think, satisfying thematically conclusion to all this. And it also would have like let Jason Statham be the guy who ends up taking everybody down, et cetera, et cetera. The ending, I agree with you guys that the ending does not work. He blinks and he doesn't go full nihilist. This could have been a nihilistic classic on par with the Counselor. It doesn't quite get there. I want to push back a little bit, Alyssa, on your point about the information delivery here, because again, there's we talk about information being obscured from the characters and what it does and the bad decisions that they make. And there's a version of the story where Jason Statham realizes, oh, I can't figure out who the villains are this way. I can't figure out who the villains are by torturing all of the criminals in town and by shooting Post Malone in the face, despite how great it is to shoot Post Malone in the face. I can't do it this way. So I'm going to embed myself in the armored car company. I'm going to figure out who the inside man is and we're going to solve the problem this way. And you get a little glimpse of that where he goes to the lady guard's house and has sex with her, and he's like, where'd you get this money from? I have pictures of your parents. If you tell anybody about me, they're gonna die. And like, okay, and so like, okay, he's gonna do this whole detective thing, or he's gonna like solve the crime this way. And then it cuts, to Jeffrey Donovan and his crew of ex-military goons.
But I think that plan is never going to work.
But I'm saying that like it was on its way to working, right? Like there's a version of this story where he starts investigating all of these people, looking for the inside man, and he eventually figures out it's Bullet or whatever. Instead, you just have Bullet tell him on the day of the robbery. He's like, I'm the inside man, and we're going to take down this score, and you're just going to sit there and take it, right? Like, I mean, it is a lot of telling us the things that are happening without having anybody actually discover them. And that is, like, it is just not dramatically or narratively satisfying.
Oh, I actually disagree, because I think the whole point of the whole point of sort of the late reveal is that, like, even this secondary plan of, like, okay, he's not going to torture them into the information, but he's going to like be a master detective. Like that also is not working. And they've set up the whole thing with like Bullet telling him because they need everybody's face verification to get into the cage, right? That like that's been something that's repeated over and over again in the sort of routine of the deliveries throughout the movie. So I actually think that's set up pretty well. Can we take 2 seconds to talk about how great Holt McCallany is in this and in everything that he's in? Like, just as, you know, can this be an objectively pro Holt McCallany podcast?
Yeah.
Just as we are. No,
yeah, I did not love him in this, and I didn't love him in Greenland recently. Did you guys see Greenland by
did
any
not.
Chance? He's in that for like 2 minutes, and I didn't like him in that either. I like him a lot.
Have you seen him in Mindhunter?
I like him in Mindhunter a lot, but there's something about his work here that is just, It's just I don't know. It's like weirdly broad for me. It didn't work.
I liked it. So some of the dialogue he has to deliver is weirdly like it's both quite specific in the way that it like in the word choices and not quite realistic. And he delivers it like he's in a 1980s David Cronenberg film. And there's this weird artifice and distance in his performance that I thought actually really worked in a super brutal, super grim genre film like this that you just don't always see where like these movies, you either get like really functional dialogue that is pretty bland at best, like you saw in Without Remorse, or you get a bunch of, collegial
Quippy.
Joking, right? It's joke cracking. And here what you had was a guy who was being given like joke cracking lines that he delivered in a way that was off, and it was interestingly off all throughout. And I loved listening to him say, like, he talks about a Chinese restaurant and he's like, are you sure you don't want to go to the Atlas, whatever, at the Starlight Lounge? Their chicken noodles are the bomb. And he just says it in a way that's like, that's haunting and strange, and like you remember that. You remember his vocal rhythms because they're so ever so slightly off. And I really loved it. I loved seeing him in this. And I think that, you know, part of the thing is that you didn't need to have Jason Statham discover that it was Holt, that it was H. You know, excuse me, that it was Bullet. That it was Bullet. Because it's Holt McCallany there to tell you that's who it's gonna be, is the guy who he's close to. The guy who is the firearms trainer, who clearly has some military background and is involved with all of this. And the movie is not going to, it's not a detective story. It's an anti-detective story about how you can't figure this stuff out. It's going to come to you because this is just sort of fate, and it's all, and all is woe.
Yeah. I also think the playing with Josh Hartnett's, like, the long attempt to turn Josh Hartnett into an action hero by casting him as just like a total coward was really fun. I enjoyed that decision.
Yeah, I thought he was good in this. I mean, I don't. It's funny. I'm complaining about this movie a lot, despite the fact that I really liked it. And I'm picking a lot of nits here because I do think it is like two ticks away from greatness. I just think it's not quite there, and that is the most frustrating sort of movie for me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I did not love Holt McElhenney in this. I thought his line deliveries were just not great, and not off-putting weird, just like not great. I don't know. He did not work for me. God, there was somebody else in this movie who, hold on, let me pull up the IMDb that I did. Eddie Marsan, who I usually love, and it plays the put upon office boss, who is like kind of freaked out by Jason Statham killing everybody all the time. Like, again, I just thought it was a weirdly inappropriate. I think the character, I didn't like how the character was written more than how he performed it. I thought he was fine in his line deliveries and stuff, but the character was just like slightly off. I know he has to play against the Rob Delaney, like, uber excited boss, but still, there's
a certain hyper reality to the movie for sure.
It exists in genre world, right? And it is a formalized and stylized genre universe that it exists in, where, you know, the sky in Los Angeles is never blue. It's always this weird whited out shade of almost, you know, quasi gray, where. Yeah. Every room is painted dark on the, you know, on the interior and the walls, and most of the floors even are super dark, right? It's a world that is not unrecognizable, but is also designed in a particular way to evoke a particular sort of form of darkness and a particular feeling. And I think all of the performances are mannered in a similar way, and work pretty well with the weird darkroom design of things. And I admire how relatively restrained this film is, knowing how Guy Ritchie just loves to sort of manically show off. And this is not a manic movie, and that's a good thing.
No, I agree with that. It really felt like a 1970s crime movie with a slightly more updated sense of how to move the camera and how to frame your shots and how to block the sequences. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Wrath of Man? Alyssa?
Thumbs up.
Peter?
Thumbs up.
Sunny, thumbs up. I still like it a great deal, even though I'm sitting here being a little nag about it. All right, so that is it for today's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode on the best of Jason Statham. This is not his best movie, believe it or not, but it's still a pretty good one. And make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences, and if we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.